At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Other than actually being the president of the United States, what do you suppose the worst job in Washington is right now? Yes, that's right. There's a new guy running the IRS from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 16th of May. Glad you could be with us. Daniel Werfel is his name, the new guy at the IRS. President Obama named him acting commissioner of the most beleaguered agency in Washington today. And it's very much a frying pan into the fire move for Mr. Werfel, who, as one of the top people at the White House budget office, has spent much of the past 6 months dealing with the sequester. Now he's got to deal with a scandal the likes of which the IRS hasn't seen in decades and an agency that wasn't in such great shape to begin with. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura gets us going today.
The IRS is a far cry from what it used to be in the 1960s.
The IRS was often held up as a model government agency, a place you wanted to work.
Lloyd Meyer teaches tax law at Notre Dame. He and other experts I talked to, including someone who recently left the IRS, told me morale there is low. The agency is understaffed.
There is an enormous number of IRS managers, soon to approach more than half of them, who are eligible for retirement.
Of course, a scandal is not going to help recruitment. NYU law professor Daniel Shaviro says staffing is just one part of the problem.
The IRS is scandalously underfunded, and it's all out of politics.
The agency's budget has fallen by $1 billion since 2010. If it got more money, the IRS could do more enforcement. But lawmakers know the prospect of more audits probably doesn't thrill constituents. So like many regulatory agencies, the IRS has been forced to do more with less. Howard Gleckman is with the Tax Policy Center. He says the IRS is under-resourced and overwhelmed, and it's developed a culture of secrecy.
The agency that expects 150 million taxpayers to fully disclose everything about their lives is unwilling to disclose very much at all about what it does.
And that's more than just collecting taxes. John Colombo teaches at the University of Illinois College of Law.
There are huge portions of the Internal Revenue Code that really are about public policy.
Like tax deductions to incentivize behavior, including home ownership. It also has to determine which groups should be tax exempt and which shouldn't. And if that's not enough, the IRS will also have to enforce the president's new health care law. Colombo says the IRS's new commissioner has to focus on restoring the agency's credibility. No one's ever going to like the IRS, he says. We're talking about taxes here, but it has to be respected. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There's a new scientific paper out that's gotten a whole lot of attention today. Scientists in Oregon have learned how to turn human skin cells into embryonic stem cells. It's a development that raises once again the prospect of human cloning, eventually, maybe, and so comes loaded with questions. Scientific, moral, legal, probably, and financial. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein has that story.
You'd think venture capitalists would be lining up to cash in on turning cells into nearly any organ in the human body. But Greg Bonfilio, managing partner of the firm Proteus, says private investors have been burned before.
When you lose a lot of money or when a nuclear bomb is go off in your portfolio, you typically stay away from that sector.
Making things even trickier for investors is that stem cell research is politically hot. With all the bioethical debates around cloning, it's been harder to get your hands on money. Tim Camp oversees the Regenerative Medicine Center at the University of Wisconsin. He works on the heart.
For example, one of the main supporters of cardiovascular research is the American Heart Association, and they've made a policy decision that they'd rather pass on funding human embryonic stem cell research.
Camp says much of his funding has come from the federal government. Since 2002, the National Institutes of Health has spent several billion dollars on human stem cell research. The NIH's Story Landis expects Washington will continue to invest, but at the same pace, despite this new research.
So it's interesting that they did this. It's a technological achievement, but is it going to change the strategies and opportunities that we have? No.
But Greg Bonfilio says this advance may change the strategy for venture capitalists.
Assume that they have now made this breakthrough. The next step in the process to bringing that breakthrough from bench to bedside is to commercialize it.
And even with all those past losses, Bonfilio says the money is going to come. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, things looked all right for a while. Then traders just gave up. I guess we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld wrote his memoirs a couple of years ago, Known and Unknown, it was called. He's out with a new book this week. It's a leadership guide of sorts called Rumsfeld's Rules, Leadership Lessons in Business, Politics, War, and Life. Quotes and sayings that he's collected through his years in government. If you want to know about his life and his history, there is his memoir. This book, though, is about how he thinks and how he makes decisions. Mr. Rumsfeld, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
This is quite a list. You've been carrying this around for a while or what?
Rumsfeld's Rules. I started collecting because my mom was a school teacher and I was a youngster. And if I didn't know the meaning of a word, she'd say, well, write it down and look it up. And then I started writing down various other thoughts and rules and ideas and anecdotes. And so I've always carried a 3x5 card and I've got now, I think, close to 300 rules, and they're not all mine, obviously. They're from people a lot smarter than I am.
There are, as you said, 300-something odd of them in here, and I'm just going to pull a couple out and run them by you and get your thoughts. So let's start with this one. It's easier, you say, to get into something than it is to get out of it. And I can't help but wonder where we would be in this country today if you guys had been thinking of that 10 years ago.
Well, I thought of that actually when I was President Reagan's Middle East envoy, and we had 241 Marines killed in Beirut at the airport. And I concluded then that the United States has to be careful about putting ground forces in because we're such a big target. And I also, over the years, came to the conclusion that the United States really wasn't organized, trained, and equipped to do nation building. So if you think of Afghanistan...
Hang on a minute. I sort of can't believe these words are coming out of your mouth now 10 years later. This was on your mind as Iraq was burbling up?
Absolutely.
And yet here we are.
Well, in Afghanistan, we had 23,000 troops in there, as I recall, when I was there. And President Obama ran them up to close to 100,000. And the situation in Iraq, we had a relatively small footprint and change the regime, which was the policy of the United States in the Clinton administration. But once you get a mission creep where people start attempting to do things well beyond that, that's obviously not something the Department of Defense is organized to do.
I will do you the favor, Mr. Secretary, of assuming that you're not trying to shift any kind of responsibility here.
Well, I'm not. It's just reality that when you do something, then someone wants you to do something else, and then something else. And over time, the mission is historically creeps into something other than was initiated at the outset.
And yet the primary critique, and I grant you, and as you well know, there have been many, the primary critique of the Bush administration in Iraq is that you guys went in without a plan to get out. And here we now are having a conversation where you say, yeah, I was thinking about all this stuff, but we went in anyway.
Well, go to my website, rumsfeld.com. You'll find 4,000 documents on there, and any number of them talk about these kinds of risks and problems. One of them was called the Parade of Horribles that I wrote well before the war and gave it to the president and the National Security Council members. It's not easy for countries to evolve and grow. But I think that both of those countries are a whale of a lot better off today than they were before. My book, of course, is not about Afghanistan.
No, of course it's not.
It's a bunch of rules.
Yeah, but you appreciate you can't have a conversation with Donald Rumsfeld about the rules he lives by without talking about these things, right?
Sure.
Yeah. All right, here's another one. You are known as a big proponent of measuring things, of knowing what you're trying to change and measuring and getting a grip on that change and assessing things. I want you to assess now yourself and your period in office as Secretary of Defense for the Bush administration. Go ahead.
Well, I'm thinking how one would do that. I think that history over time will probably be a better judge than you or I, but I've been struck by the amount of criticism that the Bush administration has received and President Bush personally, and the attempts to assign blame to him, and I think it's probably not going to sort out that way.
Others obviously disagree, and that's a conversation well beyond the scope of this interview and this broadcast, but I do wonder whether you read Robert McNamara's memoirs when they came out. Obviously, the Secretary of Defense during Vietnam.
Yeah, I have not. I served in Congress during that period.
All right. Well, here's why I ask. You know, that book was widely seen as an apology for his role in Vietnam. And I looked in this book pretty hard for any rule that you might have had about apologizing, and I couldn't find one.
And what's your question?
Did you ever think about apologizing?
Well, my goodness, you know, as Napoleon said, I've been mistaken so many times I don't even blush for it anymore. Sure, you see things that don't turn out the way you hope. You look at intelligence, and of course, if intelligence were a fact, it wouldn't be intelligence. And the idea that people concluded that President Bush made a terrible mistake by doing it, I think, is something that over time will be better understood.
Donald Rumsfeld, his new book is called Rumsfeld's Rules. Mr. Rumsfeld, thanks very much for your time, sir.
You bet.
The Federal Reserve has nothing against money, as you might imagine. They've been printing lots of it the past few years. But the government has a distinctly different view when it comes to cash it can't control, cyber cash in particular. The Department of Homeland Security has frozen an American account tied to Bitcoin's biggest trading site. Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
You know about the stock exchange. It's where people go to buy and sell shares. Well, Mt. Gox is an online trading site where people go to buy and sell bitcoins. And while bitcoins might be virtual money, you need hard, cold cash to buy it. Jim Angel is a professor at Georgetown University's business school.
Okay, well, let's suppose that you want to buy or sell bitcoins.
To do that, you might use a service like Dwolla, which is similar to Western Union or PayPal. You give Dwolla your money, and it sends it to a subsidiary of Mt. Gox. The feds say that U.S. unit broke the law, and so it froze Mt. Gox's funds with Dwolla. Helen Popper is a professor at Santa Clara University's School of Business.
The law says if you are handling money for other people, you need to say so.
But the feds say they didn't. She says one of the main reasons for the law?
The government needs to be able to make sure that they are not money laundering, that is, handling money for terrorists or for other illegal activities.
With more than $1 billion of bitcoins in circulation, there's a lot of concern about that. Popper says the Fed's actions today could put a chill on Bitcoin's business. Anyone trading through American accounts might fear having their money seized by the Feds. Advocates for digital cash are concerned that Washington wants to shut down Bitcoins in the States. Jerry Brito of George Mason University researches the regulation of new technologies.
My concern is that certain policymakers will overreact to the potential of Bitcoin to be used for bad purposes.
Brito says the real test will be whether the government even allows a Bitcoin money service to register legally. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, you want to know why NASA's $600 million telescope stopped working?
When you put things in space, they are tricky things to operate, and eventually they wear out.
Oh, all right. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average shaved off 42 points today, 0.25%, landed at 15,233. The NASDAQ erased 6 points, that's a 0.1%, 34.65 at the bell. The S&P 500 dropped 8 points, 0.5%. 1650 right there. Seems like all the retailers today blamed bad spring weather for bad quarterly earnings. Walmart unloaded 1.7%. Nordstrom slipped 0.5%. But Kohl's racked up a 4.7% gain. The store somehow expects to rebound after weak spring sales due to, yes, bad weather. Dell clicked down 0.1%. The computer company reported a drop in profit. Prestige Brand Holdings, the parent company of Dramamine, Clear Eyes, and Comet, which one of those is not like the other, reported record earnings and still somehow lost 2% of its share value today. Apple finally caught a break from investors, up 1.3%. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley each gave back more than 1%. Today, JPMorgan Chase ticked down 0.25%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.88%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the House Ways and Means Committee is scheduled to discuss the IRS's practice of targeting conservative groups. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators for April. And the New York Stock Exchange traces its roots back to May 17, 1792, when a gaggle of brokers met under a buttonwood tree on Wall Street. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The economic news out of Tokyo overnight was pretty good. The economy there grew at what you can fairly call a booming 3.5% annual rate last quarter. Nifty in and of itself, downright awesome when you remember Japan's lost decades. Credit, most of it anyway, goes to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who took office in December with a policy prescription that has come to be known as Abenomics. BBC correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes is in Tokyo. Hello.
Hello.
This thing called Abenomics that the Prime Minister has done since he came into office, what exactly is it? What's he done?
Well, what he's done is not anything entirely new. He's just combined some different things together that governments have done before into a package. And the two biggest things he's doing is a lot of government spending, so a huge new government spending plan on public works to try and get the economy moving. And that's been combined with Bank of Japan, the central bank here, printing a huge amount of money. And the Japanese stock market has shot up. The value of the Japanese yen has plummeted, and that is what the government wanted to do. It wanted to push down the value of the yen in particular because it wants Japanese companies to be able to export their goods at lower prices.
Isn't there a saying, though, that you can't devalue your way to growth? I mean, there will be a finite end to this at some point.
There will be, and there are real dangers involved in this because while exporters like it, importers hate it. Mm. And we're already seeing an increase in the price of imported goods. Japan imports a lot of food. It imports virtually all its energy. The prices of those are going up now. That's going to have a knock-on effect into the economy. That's going to affect consumers. So, you know, this is a balancing act. If it goes too far, it's going to cause a lot of problems.
Does it feel different for you now in the past, I don't know, what, year, maybe 18 months?
Public sentiment is definitely much more positive. The new Prime Minister, Mr. Abe, has certainly succeeded in convincing a lot of people here that he is the man for the job and that he really is going to change Japan. People want change. They know that what they did in the past isn't working anymore and they need to change, but also they don't want to change the way that they live. This has been a very comfortable country. This is a country where people have been looked after by the system, and change is frightening. And although people say to you, we just want Japan to change, we need a leader to change this country. If you say to them, well, you know, you're prepared to take a lower pension, you're prepared to pay higher taxes, then attitudes change very fast.
It's funny, people say the same thing here about those questions.
I think they say the same things everywhere.
Everywhere, that's right. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Tokyo. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
When the last person finally moves out of an old apartment complex that's being abandoned, or a gas station owner closes up shop, or a factory goes out of business, the empty lot that's left behind often becomes something known as a brownfield. And cleaning up those brownfields has become a focus for cities all over the country. The 2013 Brownfield Conference is going on right now in Atlanta, which is a happy coincidence because the old railroad town has one of the most successful brownfield cleanup stories out there. Jim Burris from WABE in Atlanta has the story.
When I agreed to meet Lee Harrop at a brownfield site, I pictured rusty buildings, overgrown brush, and maybe the need to wear a hazmat suit. Where we end up is so not like that. So what gives?
And would this qualify as a brownfield?
This most certainly is a brownfield. This was a brownfield, I should say.
Harrop's title is program officer for the Atlanta Beltline. Today, what he shows me is a landscaped, paved trail with skyline and park views and lots of runners and bicyclists. But until the late 1990s, where we're standing was a rail corridor. And until about a year ago, that rundown image I had in my head, well, that's exactly how this place looked.
And so people call this the Hobo Highway. It was a source of dumping. It was a source of homelessness. It was a source of just really not what you wanted to see in a city.
And when Harrop started sampling soil to find out what it would take to clean up this literal dump, he found much more of what you wouldn't want to see. Arsenic, lots of pesticides, dry cleaning solvents.
It was a wasteland.
Jenny Everett lives in the neighborhood and remembers how she avoided this area at all costs. Now, she runs along the trail 3 times a week. She says she was skeptical when she heard what the Beltline would do to the old Fourth Ward neighborhood. Color her skeptical no more.
Place is packed. You have every possible type of person out on this Beltline, from mothers strolling their children to guys and girls walking their dog to runners to bicyclists. It serves a lot of purposes for a lot of different people.
None of this comes cheap. For this 2-square-mile section of trail, the price tag was $63 million. But that spawned $750 million in redevelopment, Beltline officials say. Those developers, they wouldn't have touched this place with a 10-foot railroad spike if the city, state, and federal governments hadn't shouldered the cost of cleanup. And it's the same story in every U.S. city. Janine Betsy is a developer who heads the King Park Area Development Corporation in Indianapolis.
There sometimes could be situations where you say that you've just got to pass.
Betsy says brownfield cleanup can get expensive. So without a little help from taxpayers, developers sometimes won't take the risk. And if that seems unfair, she says, consider if you don't clean up the site.
The problem is that contamination can leak into drinking water. So you're really preserving the health of the entire community and not just cleaning up a property.
The Federal Environmental Protection Agency funds a lot of this. The EPA has spent tens of millions of dollars in some cases to clean up contaminated sites. But these days, most brownfield projects are only a few thousand dollars, says Matty Stanislaus. He's an assistant administrator with the EPA, And by taking the guesswork out of the process,
then you can quickly then conduct any necessary cleanup and then redevelop the site.
So what used to be seen as a brown liability is suddenly a green opportunity. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Kepler Space Telescope has been out there in orbit around the sun for just about 4 years, looking for other planets that might support life. There was a glitch this week, though, a pretty big one that's got the $600 million Kepler in what NASA calls a thruster-controlled safe mode, and it might not ever work right again, which is definitely not what the budgeteers at NASA were hoping for. Sally Herships reports.
So here's the thing about NASA's budget. It is smaller than it used to be, but it's still galaxy-sized, about $17 billion a year, which makes the budget for the Kepler telescope look pretty small. But what do we get for that kind of money?
5 years ago, when I would look up at the night sky, I would think to myself, there has to be a planet out there somewhere, right? There's so many stars.
Bobby Braun teaches space systems at the Georgia Institute of Technology.
But I didn't know that to be true. I just believed it.
Braun says Kepler's findings since then are going to change textbooks. The telescope has identified close to 3,000 candidates for planets and confirmed over 100. And the dreamers and astrophysicists would love to continue the search. But
when you put things in space, they are tricky things to operate, and eventually they wear out.
John Logsdon is professor emeritus at George Washington University's Space Policy Institute. He says Kepler's broken wheel isn't a case of premature failure. NASA says the telescope has already outlived its expected life of 4 years, and it says it still may find a fix.
So is there anything that we would lose by not being able to continue at this point?
Well, you lose more data. And scientists love data because that data leads to discoveries.
Both Logsdon and NASA say there's so much data from the mission already, it will take scientists years to analyze. In New York, on planet Earth, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which actual economic data confirms something we told you was coming weeks ago. We got the Consumer Price Index this morning. Inflation is another way to say that. There still isn't any in this economy, by and large. Food prices, for instance, were up just 0.2% in April. Cupcake prices, however, the actual category is fresh cakes and cupcakes, for what it's worth, they dropped 0.8%. Cupcake deflation is at long last upon us, finally. Hat tip for that one goes to economist Justin Wolfers, who you hear on this program from time to time. I don't know how he feels about cupcakes, though. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow shaved off 42 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ erased 6 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 was down 8 points. That is 0.5%. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.